Hello and welcome to another episode of FinTech Insider News. I'm Jason Bates. Today I'm joined by my FinTech 11FS colleagues, Simon Taylor and Andra Sneha. Say hi, guys.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Oh.
And joining us to bring sanity and knowledge to our world, we've got two great guests. Liz Lumley, FinTech Purse of Interest, commentator, startup Svengali and room crasher.
That wasn't me.
Say hi, Liz.
Hello.
And Mike Hurley, co-founder of Relay FM, a podcast network, and previously an ex-branch manager at a bank. Boo. And a marketing manager too.
I know.
And a marketing manager too.
Yes, I spanned across the board. Hi, everyone. Banker. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're no longer a complete banker.
I can tell you I'm very happy about it.
So everyone's here, well. Drinks in hand. Let's get on with the news. So first up, if you've been hiding in a Zen monastery or most likely had your PC turned off for a week to try and avoid the first story, it's WannaCry or WannaCrypt. It has everything. Hospitals having problems, governments, businesses affected, questions about software updates, NSA leaks, cryptocurrency. We could just spend basically the whole hour just
Bitcoin
talking about
villains.
This.
This is awesome. I feel like it's like 2009.
It has every kind of boogeyman.
Yeah.
And you couldn't go see your GP. It was perfect. It was like so quintessentially British and yet so international and yet so zeitgeist. No wonder this story took off.
And an accidental hero as well, right? The guy who just stumbled across a domain name which stopped the spreading.
So let's rewind this. For those very few people who don't know anything about it, can someone give us the background? What's this about?
I'm going to give it a go.
Okay.
So for as much as I've seen of it, so very kind of a basic overview, this is like a worm. This is a software virus that has spread its way across Windows XP machines throughout the country, throughout the planet. Actually, I think Russia, I read, was the most affected. Nobody's 100% sure where it's coming from, but these worms are infecting PCs, shutting them down, and you have to pay, what was it, like £200 or something like
$300.
$300 in Bitcoin, and it's kind of spiraled out of control.
So we all know that people that are on Windows XP are really clued up on what Bitcoin is.
Yep.
Yeah. It's kind of like somebody...
That's a really good point, actually. How are they even making the payments?
That's this crazy thing. It's kind of like somebody comes along and puts a clamp on your car, and then the only way to get the clamp out of your car is to like do something really sophisticated that you have no chance of doing if you got that clamp on your car. It's kind of ironic. And there are some conspiracy theorists out there who I think are massively wrong, but I can see how they got there, are saying, well, this was obviously a conspiracy by the NSA to make Bitcoin look bad. Because
it's number one priority of any people on the internet.
Yeah. Although there are rumors, of course, that this zero day, this worm, the exploit that was used in Windows XP did actually come from the security agencies.
Oh, it did. It was released. It was the NSA had a whole series of amount of data stolen. A group then tried to auction that on the web. Didn't get any buyers, then released it. And so this Eternal Blue exploit, which was something to do with the Samba file sharing system on Windows XP, was then thrown open. So you could have some malware, something that installed a virus on your PC.
But you had to click on the link.
You did?
Yes.
So you had to install it
to
start off
with. Had to have human error.
And then that reached out to every other PC it could find on the network and then spread itself around. So, I mean, we've had some big worms. We had I Love You and My Doom in the, like, if you look way back, that caused like
millions and millions of pounds worth of damage.
Well, so Microsoft no longer support Windows XP. And what this kind of says to me is, like, if you're, I'm thinking there's a lot of banks out there. There's probably even a lot of financial services companies out there that still have a lot of Windows XP in their estate. That's dangerous, right? And you can now see that this is almost like an idiot tax on having old software or Microsoft software. Like, if you have that software, you can also see who the people are that don't know how to use email properly, because the people who've got infected are also the people who will have clicked on one of those links. But then these things look kind of plausible, especially if you're not used to using this stuff. So you can see how it happens. What's interesting to me about this one, though, is it's been really visible. It's been really obvious that it's affected public services, where historically these ransomware attacks, usually when they're more sophisticated, go after a bank directly. They've got a targeted organization in which they're going for. It never makes the news. You get some little press release about why the systems were down inside of a bank, and then nothing is ever heard about this ever again, which says to me this wasn't a particularly sophisticated attack. Andrew, I can see you've got some thoughts.
I think that banks take security seriously because they run most of their business digitally now. Sure. If we think it's good or not, their digital service, it's something else. But they do take security seriously, and that's why they have not been affected. I think about this situation in NHS and probably many other public service, public institutions in UK, which had their budget cut. And the IT guy who would try to explain, you know, it's important, security is important, this could happen, and still the decision was taken. This is for me like a crime in a way, to decide to leave these systems exposed. Somewhere a decision was taken in UK for the size of NHS, for example, that there is no policy, there is no... it looks very unprofessional, and I'm sure it was not unprofessional. I'm sure NHS has security people, you know, out there who probably were begging for the money to do something about it. And I think what happened in NHS is not only this lack of strategy and action and so on, but there are a lot of equipments which use...
MRI scanners and CT scanners with embedded software in. And if you've spent sort of 10 or 15 million on one of these big scanners, and, you know, who are you going to pay in order to update these things.
Yeah, and I think what annoys me in all this is that there is no serious discussion about the responsibility and the model of how this works. Because we have on one side these institutions which are supposed to take care of us, you know, but by spying on us. But on the other side, they should take a proactive attitude to protect the institutions which are essential for a country, you know, like this one. And if you read the National Cybersecurity Strategy published last year in November with this event in mind, it's laughable. It's just laughable.
Well, and it's laughable because of this idea that there is such magic in which you could instruct somebody to put a backdoor into every type of cryptography ever, so that then if anything ever went wrong or terrorism ever happened, you could totally decrypt any conversation. Whereas actually, every time you store a backdoor, somebody can steal it and use it to do something like this.
But equally, you might say, I'm playing devil's advocate, I don't agree with that, with the backdoor theory at all. But actually, if without cryptography, this wouldn't be able to happen on two ways. Firstly, the ransomware encrypted your PC with strong encryption. So you've got your data, you've got everything there, and basically everything's been encrypted with someone, and no one can put the compute power necessary to decrypt that without the key. So instantly someone's taken all of your stuff without taking it from your PC.
If we didn't have cars, nobody would die on the roads.
Sure, but secondly, then using Bitcoin as a way of anonymously moving money around the world in order that thieves can blackmailers
so
can get
stuff. The FT came out and said this only happened because Bitcoin exists, which I thought was remarkably enlightened from the FT.
Let me take a guess at who wrote that.
Yeah, and it's kind of like saying crime only exists because I don't know, there's now cryptography. It's kind of obtuse. Like, I can see crime existing because there are bad people in the world. But this thing is kind of out there. Like, sure, this Bitcoin does actually make it really, really easy to link a cryptographic locker to a cryptographic key that unlocks that and unlocks your PC in order for you to get payment. But it's also massively transparent. So if you want to get caught money laundering, use Bitcoin. Unless you're really, 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 really sophisticated, in which case you can hide yourself on Bitcoin. But then compare this to the existing financial system. More crime happens in the US dollar than any other currency in the world by about 10 to 1. Of the crime that happens in the US dollar, there's an estimated 2 $2 trillion of money laundering every year. Of that $2 trillion, we see 2% of that in the system. Of the 2% we see, we prosecute 2%. So we have a shoddy financial system.
But having said that, I think again that's a little bit, you know, tangential, because if Bitcoin wasn't here, and with all the AML and KYC and everything else that interbank transfers need, how would you have got money out? So I don't think it's like, you know, I don't know, people wouldn't die if there weren't cars, but we need cars. It's like, I don't know, murders happen less when there aren't handguns lying around. So, you know, handguns do have a part to play. And I actually think Bitcoin and the anonymous transfer of money across the globe also has, you know, because we've seen the Disney film held to Bitcoin ransom again. There are lots of crime.
There are less positive uses of a handgun than there are like uses of money, because surely, yes, you can use money for bad, but you can use money for good. The fact that you've changed how you transfer it, the point is, the actual corollary here is the US dollar. The US dollar can be used for good and bad. The British currency can be used for good and bad. The idea that Bitcoin is anonymous is a misnomer. You can trace every transaction throughout history very, very easily. Yes, you can't necessarily peg an identity onto it, but it's relatively trivial to do that. There are companies like Chainalysis and Scorechain. It's a reason we caught the people behind Silk Road, is because it's actually relatively trivial, unless you're really, really, really sophisticated.
I was going to say, there are tumblers. You can change it into different currencies in unregulated or different cryptocurrencies and unregulated exchanges.
But it's all traceable.
And I'm sure there's a...
But it's all traceable. So if somebody's using a tumbler, then you know that there's suspicion. And then you can follow the money. So yes, they've tumbled it through 30 different places, but I can see the 30 different places that they moved it to. And then they move it to another 30 places, but I can see all of those 30 places they moved it to. So you just follow the money, and eventually it comes out at a bank account. And you hope that when it comes out at a bank account, the actual financial system can keep up. The biggest problem you've got isn't Bitcoin, it's the financial system as it exists today.
Oh, I think that's a cop out.
And that is the position of several regulators and law enforcement agencies, because they're active users of those services. And indeed, the NSA came out on CoinDesk a couple of days ago, and I can't remember where they made the speech, saying that Bitcoin isn't something we should be afraid of. I think law enforcement is actually now starting to gently encourage the idea of this sort of transparency in financial services.
What do you think, Mike, as an ex-bank manager?
Well, I'll sound the Bitcoin point. I understand what you're saying about the traceability, but I don't necessarily think that the people that are spreading this think they can be traced as easily.
Oh, of course.
Right. So, like, the idea of this not existing without Bitcoin, I actually think that there is a real sense in that, because there is no, I don't think there's any way that somebody who's putting a hack like this in place, or a worm like this in place, would put a bank account number in there. Like, there would be no financial incentive for them unless Bitcoin existed. Otherwise, they'd just be doing it for fun.
Ransomware used to exist with PayPal email addresses, and it was then they'd have mule accounts. And
but like, I think today, like, because then I think back then people thought that PayPal was what Bitcoin is now.
Yeah,
like an untraceable system. It's like, oh, I'll just set up a Gmail account anywhere. Like, so I think that without these systems that seem to be, or like perceptually are untraceable, these types of things wouldn't exist.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. They are perceiving that they can get away with it. Yeah. That's why they're doing it. But the point I'm making is they can't. So to assume it's at fault is to miss the nuance.
Well, okay, but what I was going to say, like, same if we're putting these cryptography backdoors in, a lot of that doesn't really matter, right? Because if you're looking at what the arguments will be from government agencies, right? Like, this is another example of why there should be backdoors. This WannaCry will be used as, this is why we need cryptography backdoors, so we can stop this stuff happening.
And the irony is, of course, they don't realize this. It came from a backdoor.
But that doesn't matter, because it's they realize it, but it's what the general public will realize.
And
right?
One podcast at a time, you listeners are going to turn public perception around.
This is going to become like another platform, probably in the election. Right, for technology reform and for GCHQ to put more in place to make sure these things will never happen again. So there'll be backdoors in absolutely everything.
So from one hack to another, Andra, after years of warning, mobile network hackers have finally exploited SS7. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah, so it's not the first exploit. It's just the first exploit which touches the banking world. And it happened in Germany, where a type of interaction with a customer for doing a transaction is requires the bank to send a PIN, a code, a TAN code, to the user by the text message. So what happened in this process is that the hackers used a flaw in a protocol which is called SS7, Signaling System 7. And this protocol is responsible for forwarding actually calls and messages, but also transmitting data packages from your phone. So
I understood that in the 80s, it was what was needed in order to allow telcos and network operators to interconnect and exchange data. But it was put in place so that I could look into any back end system in any telco in the world and not only get data, but listen in on calls, redirect, do anything globally.
Yeah, there are a number of things. Actually, in the GSM network, only the phone authenticated itself, but not the network. Now it's different. The phone authenticates, but the network needs to authenticate itself. Sure. So when the protocol was created, this was the situation. Also, the channel used for sending this channel, SS7, for sending data is different from the voice channel. So it sends a lot of information about you and your phone in order to pass you from one node to the other.
Yes.
So this is when they can hack it very easily. So this happened now in the banking world, and the accounts were emptied simply because somebody could interfere in this exchange. Basically, they forwarded the messages to another phone, and usually during the night they entered in the account and they emptied the account of that respective.
So again, it's quite sophisticated because they had to essentially take control of someone's PC. They had to get their banking credentials and then pay someone or access a telco network in order to then, when they went to log in and move a ton of money around, they got a two-factor authentication message to their cell phone that then these guys redirected. I mean, like, this is, again, the plot of a film. This
very
is
targeted, this one.
Very super targeted, sophisticated.
Basically, way more sophisticated than the last one. This is really, really clever stuff, isn't it?
But it has been done before. I think it has been done before many times. But in public, it became
How much money was stolen?
Not much, but they don't make public this information. How much money had been stolen? So the guy who disclosed how this works and why it's flawed, he did this in a presentation at a conference in Germany in 2014, and so you can see it if you want. It's very interesting. But also in 2014, another hack happened using SS7, and it was during the time of conflict around Crimea between Russia and Ukraine.
Right.
So the phones of the American diplomats in Ukraine have been hacked using this method. And there is a lot of information about it. So it's a known hack, you know, and it...
Yeah, phones are easier to hack these days.
Yeah, and
but is this not another thing about legacy technology, legacy networks, legacy infrastructure, whether it's Windows XP boxes that haven't been updated, and even though all of the big problems were fixed in like Service Pack 2 or something, are still open, and you've got this old protocol that is, you know, unsecure and can be exploited. You know, how many other protocols and old tech is there, especially in banks, I guess, you know?
The funny thing about this SS7 thing is the way that they can really get it to you is by hacking the two-factor, which is something that we're all supposed to be doing now to be more secure. So, like, when I read this, I was like, well, now I need to change everything. Because I use a bunch of text message two-factors, but there are a lot of things called, like, OTP, one-time passwords, which are all done via applications. So now I'm going to have to move to those. Right, to stop myself getting these SMS messages.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the standard for a lot of online banking. Some online banks, you will go to make a payment to a new payee for faster payments, which is anything up to £100,000. And they say, and this happens, you know, banks do this around the world. It's not just the UK. This one-time PIN I know is used heavily across Europe. I've seen it in Latin America. I've seen it in Southeast Asia. It's kind of the, oh, well, we've got a second factor of authentication. So we're kind of secure now, except for when somebody hacks the phone of our customers, in which case they're not. It's kind of hard for the banks in this case, because the alternative was sending out those old card readers.
Which everybody, I mean, I was...
everyone loves those.
The bank that I worked for, I was working in the branches when they sent those keys out. And it was just, it was pandemonium. People were going crazy. Like lines out the door. People just didn't want this to carry around this keychain with them every time they wanted to log on to their internet banking app.
So this brings the balance. Like how much fraud is acceptable before you're annoying your customers? Because you're going to have some fraud, but how much do you want to annoy your customers going about day-to-day life? Because not all of the customers are going to be defrauded all of the time using these exploits. Actually, how much is it going to happen? And where's the balance between your really nice, easy-to-use products that... and protecting customers, because a lot of what you see from the banks at the moment is more around customer education. We've seen Barclays have a lot of adverts on TV at the moment about this sort of stuff, really trying to help people be aware of, you know, what phishing looks like and what.
Don't click on that link.
Don't click that link. Whatever you do,
any links, just don't click them.
There's no downside to not clicking. Like if you don't click that link, your life goes on absolutely fine. If the bank wants you, they get hold of you.
I think we should just type in all URLs, like, you know, manually, yeah. for good now. Like, that's it. I'm so scared. No more clicking links.
And also on the one-time password thing, like sending an SMS with a one-time password is kind of antiquated when you've got a device that has so many sensors in it. It has geolocation, it can take your fingerprint, it can take your face, it can take your voice. Like there are two-factor authentication is one thing, seven-factor authentication would be really, like why not use that stuff? It's sitting right there and your app is right there on the I'm pointing at the phone, sorry.
But they do, and that's, you know, that's definitely coming. And there are a lot of companies that are offering everything from, you know, how you hold your phone, how you move it, how you tap the screen, where you are, location.
They can tell whether it's you or not. Yeah.
You know, all, you know, and there's a lot of development on that at the moment.
But I saw.
But again, we're catching up.
I remember when I worked for a company who used to sell to banks, trying to get banks to buy this in 2010. Like, banks just don't buy this stuff because they'd rather... And look, I'm all for consumer education. I'm all for above-the-line marketing. But, like, there are some lower-cost solutions here that could create great user experiences that actually aren't that difficult and pretty easy to put in. So I take your point, Jason. It is coming, but, God, I'd like it to come faster. Sorry, rant over.
Okay, on to the next story. Zopa becomes the first of the big three peer-to-peer lenders to be authorized by the regulator.
Yeah, by the FCA in the United Kingdom. So Zopa are a peer-to-peer lender. So unlike a bank that lends you money off their balance sheet, so basically they take deposits from you or me, our wages go in there, and then they're able to lend money against that. Peer-to-peer lending says that actually you're going to borrow some money from somebody else effectively. Somebody else is going to give you that money and they're going to get the interest rather than the bank collecting the interest, although that's not actually how it ends up working because there's a whole bunch of other stuff that goes on, but that's another story for another day. So Zopa have been pushing for some years to make peer-to-peer lending a regulated activity under the Peer-to-Peer Finance Association, the P2PFA. And they've campaigned for that because they believe that consumers need protection and actually having some rules around that.
But they also campaigned at the same time that the FCA was suddenly starting to pipe up to say, there's some investor detriment here. Like how the terms work, how you put money in. Do you really understand the risks? Do you really understand how these platforms work and that your money is at risk? So, you know, I totally buy into the fact that Zopa have been pushing the industry, but you might say that was in advance of the regulator stepping up and before some really big issue happened.
Of course. And I think the negotiation went something like this. If you come up with your own rules, we'll give you a little sweetener. And a little, I don't think it was said in those terms.
But shall I consult the 11FS lawyers now?
Yeah, probably. This is for Dick Insider.
It's a satirical podcast, while I'll hasten to add.
I'm for some. Okay, so the FCA authorization allows Zopa to offer the new innovative finance ISAs. And the company says it's plans to apply for the Treasury for the permission to become an ISA manager. So this actually allows them to offer sort of savings account type stuff. And really, they've been planning to look at maybe a banking license. We're seeing And I think this is an interesting model. You see people starting in either money transfer. We've seen Revolut and TransferWise looking at banking licenses. Now you've got the peer-to-peer lenders that started in lending. Everybody finds their footing somewhere and then eventually wants to become a bank.
Everyone wants to be a bank now. It's this the hot new thing. Everyone wants to be a bank.
And it's like, except the banks who are kind of like, no, you really don't want these guys.
They want anything but, right? But
We want to offer new services. We want to do lending and we want to have APIs and do a whole host of stuff.
But it is a thing. I mean, we talked about this the last podcast. You know, being a bank and being regulated is there's a certain amount of trust in that. And I mean, Zope is pretty open saying that it's an investment. You know, you're it's not a savings account. And so getting FCA regulated is a little bit of marketing. It's, you know, you can, as a customer, you're like, oh, okay, the government is watching you. Oh, you're a bank. Oh, you're trustworthy. Oh, okay, you do offer savings. You know, so it is a little bit of PR and marketing. It's, I mean, the big three aren't charlatans. They're very clear that it's an investment product that they're offering. But now they are moving into that little bit of perception for the consumer market that they are a safe place.
And maybe that helps them become mass market. I mean, maybe it doesn't, but there's definitely something to be said for if they are now regulated. There are people that would use fintech apps regardless of whether they were or they weren't, and the people who really get comfort from the fact that they're regulated. And in a world of open banking PSD2, it means that if you see their logo inside your big bank name here app and you want to get a loan from them instead of getting a loan from your bank and it's at a better rate and you find out they're regulated, maybe that helps.
Yeah.
There's something that still interests me about the peer-to-peer market and how it's moving towards marketplace lending. You know, it's actually then taking hedge fund money and, you know, and sovereign wealth and whatever, and then sending that out under the guise of this is peer-to-peer. The fact that your peer is, you know, some hedge fund manager in a, you know, and is it, what is it that makes them different as a lender? You know, is it that, is it a consumer view that I think that Sarah's really lending me the money, or are they fundamentally a different lender, or are they just something new?
I think they've done some innovative things around how they score risk. I think they've done some innovative things about how they create consumer experiences, but actually they've discovered, like everybody, that there's only so much liquidity in the marketplace and it all belongs in financial markets. And actually, if you want serious liquidity, you've got to go get it financed. The fact that, you know, nearly 80% of the liquidity is coming from, as you say, the asset manager space, says to me that they've realized that pretty quickly. And actually, as they move into potentially taking deposits, that would be a vehicle for them to have massive amounts of liquidity and to be able to fund their own book. So from a business case standpoint, it's weird that the lending model went, oh, wow, we can do peer-to-peer and this is really innovative, and then went, actually, the way the banks have been doing it all along probably makes sense.
What do you think, Mike, from a consumer perspective? How do you see peer-to-peer lenders?
I think that a lot of people like them because it's not the establishment, right? So, like, everybody hates a bank, but, you know, like, I think that tends to be the way, right? Like, oh, they were responsible for the credit crunch. So then these new companies pop up. And I think it's, you know, it's why the Monzos of the world are getting traction now, because it's like, this is the underdog story. I do find it funny that everybody's going for these banking licenses. So I'm interested to see how marketing changes, right? Working in a bank, doing marketing, direct marketing, our biggest problem was FCA regulation. And every single sentence, every single word, every single letter was scrutinized to make sure it didn't upset the FCA. And I'm wondering how, like, a lot of these companies and institutions that are starting to get their licenses, I'm interested to see how their marketing could get impacted and if it's going to become more stale as time goes on, which I think could end up affecting them.
Very interesting.
Honestly, I think anyone looking for a banking license needs their head examined.
I don't think they know what they're getting into.
So with the work
you've done, you know, with fintech startups, Liz, do you still see P2P and, you know, different lending models coming through
That was kind of what at Startup Bootcamp we saw a few years ago. There was a lot of lending. And then 2015, there was a lot of asset management. And last year, it was SME banking. So there seemed to be these movement and trends. But there was a real tailing off in the lending and the P2P space over the past few years.
What's the next trend after SME banking?
I really think it's going to move into capital markets, but and risk and reg tech. In all that place, yeah.
Yeah, financial markets are crying out for this.
Mm. Cool. Well, staying on the startup and do you need your head examined to get a banking license? I guess we've got some unfortunate news about Tandem. There was a story this week around Tandem having to essentially cut their headcount from 110 people to 80 people after having seen £29 million of funding fall through from House of Fraser. They were going to raise £35 million, but only got £6 million in the end. And without the additional money, Tandem couldn't exit mobilization, which is the 12-month period you get after getting a banking license with restrictions to show that everything's in place, to have all the money in place, and then to start launching those products. So it was really sad. We know Ricky and the guys over there, and they've been on FinTech Insiders, and that was a problem. That's a real problem.
Yeah, it's a real. I just feel sad about this one. I don't think you can take any joy in it. I mean, the fact that they are doing the right thing to keep the doors open is probably a hard decision for everybody involved. And there's a lot of talent in that organization. And I think there are some other organizations out there that will do very, very well to pick that up. I'm sure they'll all do really, really well with Tandem on their CV. I'm sure it's a positive experience for everybody involved. Although in the long term, in the short term, I'm sure it's pretty hard.
Well, I mean, Ricky's a rock star, and although they've lost the ability to take deposits, he's come out and said, look, we're shrinking, we're refocusing, restructuring. They're going to offer a credit card in a few months and actually sort of get back on. But it must be tough when you've been, you know, valued at what, 65 million, you've had a good few funding rounds, you know, is there a down round coming? Who puts money in? Yeah. That must be quite a tough story.
The carpet was pulled out from under them. Yeah, no, I agree. I don't think there's any joy in this at all.
So on to, I guess, another, like we've got sad stories leading up to the break today. I'm feeling a real downer on this. Virgin Money walks away from Co-op Bank takeover talks after months of speculation.
Yeah, but come on, it's kind of like they walked away from a train wreck. I mean,
that's what I know. It must be really bad.
I mean, I didn't really know about this until I saw they've walked away. Why were they trying to buy them? Like Virgin bought their own license, right? They bought their way into a license. Who was it that they...
At Northern Rock, they picked up. So they've already got enough distressed assets to be doing.
So what, were they trying to get more branches? Like, why would you want that? Like, I couldn't work out what they were hoping to get out of the co-op.
Customers, I guess.
That's what they were going for? They just wanted to buy some people.
It's really interesting because we've spoken about this before that, you know, essentially 2013 when background checks against the co-op because they were looking to buy what's become TSB... suddenly showed that there was a 1.5 billion hole in their assets. They escaped bankruptcy. They raised money from some specialist investors, and then But in the end, the cooperative group share price dropped to sort of 20% of what it was, and they've been limping along since. But what's been amazing for me is that even though you know they've probably got less capital than they need according to the regulator, and that they're you know that all kinds of things are in place for if they falter. Their customers have been crazily loyal. So even with this problems, even with the fact that they've had a drug scandal with their former chairman, branch closures, big losses. So they announced that they lost $477 million this year, which brings their losses up to $2.7 billion over the last 5 years.
Oh, God.
They've still got, you know, 4 million customers who are there.
I think somebody makes a specific choice to go with the co-op. And I don't think any of those things undo that choice. Like whatever your choice was to choose them over a bigger bank, you're going to stick with it. Yeah,
but
I think.
Did they have any tech inside that Virgin Money might want?
Famously, one of the major issues when the CEO, I think, was pushed out about a year ago was they tried to upgrade their core banking system and made such a botched job of it that it was actually a bit of a scandal.
Like what were Virgin? This seems like a nightmare.
Yeah.
Which is probably why they've walked away, right?
Yeah,
like, they found more.
And look, the strategy of buying a high street bank and consolidating under a global brand worked really well for Santander, but Santander have been doing that across Europe for 20, 30 years, and they know what they're doing, and they know when they're looking at a train wreck and when they're looking at something that's quite well run. Unfortunately, when they picked up Alliance and Leicester, it wasn't in bad shape. And what else did they pick up?
Abbey.
Yeah.
I think the really interesting thing for me is, out of all of those that we've mentioned, none of them have such a strong consumer ethical brand, which is part of the problem of buying them, because are you going to buy them and keep the brand and grow it? Because you're going to lose so much value if you fold those customers into your existing.
The Virgin brand thing is very different to the Co-op brand.
I can't imagine them, and I can't imagine Virgin keeping a brand alive that isn't theirs. Like, all that Virgin is a brand. That's all it is, right? Mm-hmm. So they would have just rebranded it, and then I feel like they probably would have lost a lot of the customers that they were hoping to attract. Like, it seems like a very, very strange deal to me.
So it looks like the market, at least the share price, is looking like this thing isn't going to fly. It's not going to work. You know, bonds have dropped 50% of their value in, I think, February, January, and now to 25%. So there's a, you know, so there's
someone,
a definite...
Someone's going to come in. Right now,
it's probably going to end up being some auditors, and just it's looking like it's heading that way. Or private equity buys it, and then it gets fire sold.
Did we have any bank dying like this of a good debt? Let's say just looking at it. And
usually they get bought out long before this happens, yeah. But everybody's seeing such a train wreck that nobody wants to buy it. I think it ends up at like
even two banks bought Lehman Brothers.
Eventually it's going to trade so far below its book value that some PE house will take it, and at which point that PE house has some interesting decisions in front of it. Like, I imagine if somebody was to say, all right, your life now depends on saving this thing, what are you going to do? You start thinking, well, I don't know. I think I'd just start again and see who wants to come.
Maybe they want us to go and, hey, look, if you want us to come and rebuild the co-op, I'm in. Yeah. Like, give us a call.
Yeah, that's the way forward.
So with that doom and gloom, I think we'll throw over to the sponsors.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
Critical mass. That's what turns the smallest ventures into life-changing forces. Reach critical mass by joining Temenos Open Marketplace for Fintechs, opening up access to 2,000 of the world's largest financial institutions. Don't just take our word for it. Temenos Marketplace has just one reader's choice Best Emerging Innovative Technology Product and Service at the 2016 Banking Technology Awards. Join Temenos now. We make the money go round.
Let's be honest. Most digital banking experiences just aren't that amazing. Learn how more than 180 banks worldwide, including Barclays, Deutsche Bank, and BBVA, innovate faster with Strands as their trusted fintech partner. To find out more, visit strands.com today.
11FS Pulse Update.
Hello, listeners. This is Ross from 11FS.
And this is Megan from 11FS.
Megan, it's been a busy old time recently. There's been a lot going on in the payment space and the challenger propositions. What's happening?
There sure has been, Ross. So the first update comes from Revolut. They now allow customers to transact in Polish zloty and Swiss franc. Circle, another payments app, has just launched in France. And N26 over in Germany now allows customers to take out savings products. And this is done via partnership with Raisin.
Nice, we like N26.
We sure do. And Ross, is there anything happening with the traditional high street banks?
Yeah, an interesting development just this week. Santander in the UK have launched a new mobile banking app called Flight, F-L-I-T-E. It did literally just launch a couple of days ago, so we're in the process of capturing that and adding it into the Pulse platform.
Great, and where can our listeners find out more information on Pulse and view these customer journeys?
As always, head over to 11fs.com and look up 11FS Pulse, where you can see these and hundreds of other end-to-end digital banking journeys and experiences.
So thanks again to our sponsors, and thanks Megan and Ross for the Pulse Minute. Okay, so the world's most successful mobile money market is introducing cross-network transfer systems. What does that mean in plain English?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I was hoping you wouldn't like come to me. I'd be like,
Does that mean? Yeah.
So having read the stories in today's news, Liz.
I read off, I just didn't read that one.
This one is basically in Kenya. We've seen Safaricom and M-Pesa has been tremendously successful for a number of years. So this is where you can can pay each other with airtime. So I would buy some airtime from my shop. And instead of it just buying the ability to call people and send messages, I can also send people that airtime as a way to pay for things. And that's been a case study in how to do mobile money in regions that don't have good banking infrastructure. And in a number of markets like Tanzania, what we'd seen is that those natural monopolies like M-Pesa weren't really there. So there were a number of airtime companies. So it's kind of like, imagine the colliery would be, in the US, it would be Verizon and AT&T and T-Mobile. Or in the UK, it would be Vodafone and O2 and everybody. They all had their own network, and the only people you could pay were the people on your own network, which is okay, especially because a lot of the way mobile networks were done by village. So everybody in one village would be on one mobile network. But actually, the amount of transactions you can have are limited, because even if you have 80% of the market, there was 20% of the market that you couldn't pay. And over the last few years, Safaricom has gradually dipped to 70% of the market as others have aggressively moved in. So the Kenyan government has now mandated that Safaricom needed to open up, and Safaricom, in a shocking turnaround, have gone, oh, this is a great idea. We think this will lead to more mobile money transactions, and we fully support it, which is often the way when they're forced to do something. They put a positive spin on these things. But actually, it's interesting to see that mobile money interoperability is something we're seeing in emerging markets. And it's a very different evolution to what we see, you know, kind of in traditional markets, or even in China, India, where they've kind of gone more the mobile app route. It's different to what we've seen in the US, where the private market and Venmo has kind of taken over and done peer-to-peer. In the UK, we can kind of all rely on our bank accounts. In Europe, SEPA's sort of there and thereabouts. So this is an interesting example, because will that interoperability go out of country, and will we have now an entire new way of people moving money between each other and creating economies? It's definitely something that you should be studying if you want to know what the future of money looks like in sub-Saharan Africa.
It's interesting that we have that sort of digital identity in, you know, Estonia and the Nordic regions. We've got mobile money transfer in Africa. We've got WeChat in China. You know, there are all of these very strong paradigms and approaches that are proving themselves in a particular region. But the question is always, like, where does that spread? You know, M-Pesa has been around for a very long time and was always quoted at those conferences of, this is the way we'll all go. And, you know, it really didn't happen. That.
Well, Vodafone at the Mobile World Congress every year would kind of do the, we've got M-Pesa. And it was like, yeah, okay, because through Vodacom, you've got Safaricom, and you're going to take over mobile money. But Mobile World Congress is where you go to learn what mobile operators aren't going to do for the next 5 years.
Like, see, Yes.
So I guess moving on and talking, keeping that interoperability theme, Liz, Symphony, a secure messaging app, has just got $63 million of investment at a billion valuation. Mm-hmm. Unicorn horn.
Ooh. My Lord. I was really happy with this, because finally, you know, we can talk about something that's not about retail banking and payments. It's great. Just a little background. I mean, when I started writing about the technology that's used at banks, it was about real-time market data on trading floors. It was about trading floor infrastructure in capital markets. And famously, market data managers and IT managers hated the Bloomberg terminal, absolutely hated it. You couldn't commingle the data. It was actually a physical hard box that had to sit separately on the trader's desktop. That's one of the reasons why they hated it. But this is kind of like a lesson in fintech history, is that Mike Bloomberg didn't build the terminal for the market data managers. He built it for the bond traders. He built it for the customer based on what they wanted. And of course, bond traders have a certain reputation in the financial services industry. And, you know, they like to chat, and you can talk on the Bloomberg terminal, and there's little stuff that you can play with, and it's very social. And so my whole career, there was always this talk that someone's going to come up with a Bloomberg killer. I think Reuters probably had a little, you know, a little group somewhere in a basement.
An innovation lab.
It's actually when Reuters kind of went to attack Bloomberg, since Bloomberg was basically just a giant mainframe, I think they're the world's largest employer of Fortran programmers, you know, the Bloomberg could see very much that this group, this Reuters group in Connecticut, was just downloading all this data because they could see everything. It was all very centralized. Sorry to go into the history of Bloomberg. So, but then Symphony is getting a lot of attention in the press that covers the capital markets technology because it is the Bloomberg killer. Now, when I first started talking to banks about technology, you know, this was during the client-server revolution. Banks were going to build their own proprietary operating systems. So Of course, Symphony is a consortium, is a being put together by a consortium of banks. So banks aren't going to go for a third-party messaging app to come in and kill Bloomberg. They're going to build it themselves.
And this what I love about this, Liz, sorry to
No, keep on going, yeah.
What I love about this is it's very different to like the big consortiums of 75 banks that never really get anywhere. Sorry, R3, there's a lot of people I like there, but you haven't done anything. The Symphony is a small group of them. It's Goldman are involved, and I think there's a couple of others. And then, of course, you've got Google Ventures having put money into it. And that, to me, is really interesting.
All the data on how traders behave, Google
right.
is...
Right? Yes. Like, I wonder why they're interested. And I guess what this says to me is like fintech is coming to capital markets. And actually here, especially with the type of organization that's been investing in fintech for quite some time.
Yeah, but fintech has been in capital markets for ages. You know, the National Association of Securities Dealers launched an automated quotation system in 1971 when retail branches were still doing passbooks. They have been electronic for a very long time.
Without question. But I think the model here is slightly different in that this just has a different feel to it, and the fact that Google Ventures is involved. I think that's the thing that you wouldn't have seen before. And I think the other thing that you wouldn't have seen before is the fact that they've spun this out as a pure technology company that actually starts to feel and look a lot more like a technology company. And I think that culture change is going to be more transformational than the fact that of course, capital markets have been doing technology for a long time in finance and technology. But I speak to a number of former colleagues and friends in the capital market space, and they will tell you they're still pulling their hair out because middle and back office in financial markets is still remarkably painful. You think retail's bad, you think corporate's bad, like financial markets really takes the biscuit. And of course you've got really very, very high value transactions, massive amounts of money moving, all written somewhere on a spreadsheet where somebody can get the number wrong. I mean, it's 2017 and we're talking about trillions moving back and forth every day and there are spreadsheets involved. And I just kind of want the tech to be a bit better and a bit more robust.
So from back office innovation, from capital markets innovation to a different type of innovation theater maybe, Amex debuts its first Alexa skill. So the story here is that the skill lets Amex card members check their balances, access accounts and offers, pay bills, and hear recent account information with the help of Amazon's voice assistant. So I've said it. Do you think I've just now
You've committed podcast heresy.
Is that it?
Because I do technology shows. We have to talk around it or bleep it. Because our listeners go crazy.
Michael, you're going to have to bleep this.
Yeah, so we just called Echo. Then you're good.
Okay, so
just go with the Echo.
Echo, tell me my American Express account. Yep. But the thing that I liked buried sort of deep in this story, which was in Fortune, was that you have to give like an authorization code. And it just makes me think of Star Trek. It makes me think of Jean-Luc telling the Enterprise to blow up, you know, confirmation code Alpha 9034. That's what we're
talking. Oh, Grey Hulk.
Exactly. Make it so. So
it was funny. People were talking this morning at this breakfast I did that American parents are complaining that Echo is making their children rude. You know, so they're trying to change it to say, please.
Why not? Why not have some humanity in your robotics? The other thing, I don't know if anybody watched Google I.O. when it was aired a couple of days ago, but Google I.O. announced that their Google Assistant will now let you type to the assistant rather than talk to it. Because in a public place, trying to talk to your technology is really, really awkward. And I'm surprised that wasn't something they thought of before. But also, I wonder if it's something we're going to start seeing more of, because it's really just part of that machine learning revolution. Machine learning baked deep into the OS.
That's classic. The like people get really excited by the tech instead of thinking about how people might actually use it.
Well, I think they initially debuted Assistant without this because they wanted to sell their product home, right? They wanted to sell the physical thing you talk to. So they're having people talk to it. Because you could talk to it inside of chat applications, right? So Allo, which was their chat app that they launched last year, you could talk to the assistant. But now you can talk to it from anywhere because no one uses Allo. It's like originally it was like, we'll put it in here to get people to use this and otherwise you speak to it and we sell you this tube.
But I still think it shows how early we are in the voice home technology side of things. You have got Echo, you've got the Google Home, you've got a whole host of things which are just amazing. We've got some at home. My wife, my son have never, I think, picked up a technology since the iPad as quickly in order to make things happen. But at the same time, we don't have authentication. It doesn't know who you are. I heard of a great new sort of
Google Home now knows who you are.
I heard of a great type of vandalism of walking down a street and shouting into people's closed windows like, Alexa, Metallica, Volume 10, you know, and away
and
you go.
Did it. You just did it for all
you
your listeners.
Did podcast vandalism.
So you know, it just shows you how amazing it is. But again, we're at the start of one of those technology curves where the interaction of screens and voice and, you know, a whole host of
it's coming. It's awkward and gaudy right now, isn't it? But it's coming. And again, I'd encourage you to watch IO's machine learning stuff from last night because they're adding sophistication slowly and surely to it. And look, an Amex skill where you can authenticate something is a little bit of a press release and it's not that amazing. Yeah. But the fact that I can soon say whilst I'm sitting at home, oh, crap, I forgot to pay Andrew that £5 for coffee the other day. Insert name of your device function here, pay Andrew £5, please. Authorization 12345. And actually, that's really cool. And the ability to do that from inside any chat application or wherever, because the machine learning is contextually aware, that to me is really nice, invisible banking that we should be moving towards.
True. May I add something? So while I get that many people are excited about this voice thing, for me, it's a problem and it's an accessibility problem. That's why I value very much the text insight, for example. So I'm partially deaf. And not only that I'm deaf, but I have an accent. I didn't manage to get rid... and I'm a woman. So this affects the interaction with such an device both ways. So I tried at times to park and with this type of devices, and you have to spell the number of your car of the plate. I ended up 15 minutes crying in the parking lot because the app would not be able to identify the spelling. I would say L. P, no, nothing. That on one side. So I'm used that these automatic things do not understand me on one side. I could scream at Alexa and Alexa would tell me, nah, sorry, no. And on the other side, Alexa would tell me stuff and I would be like, what? So for me, it would be such a bizarre interaction. So I'm sure there are many people, I mean, in the world. So, but this type of interaction, fast interaction, of course, is usable. But the variety of interactions out there is massive. It's not only voice. Yeah.
So I guess moving on to our last story and actually taking this voice theme on and equally the accents and women and how different voices and different personas affect different things. There was an amazing article in the Harvard Business Review, Liz, this week about recording VCs' conversations.
So this was a study from a Swedish university where they recorded VCs' conversations in evaluating startups founded by women and startups founded by men. And there, actually, this week also, numbers came out that women get 2.1% of all VC funding, which is down from 7% a few years ago, which is fucking criminal. So some of the differences in the way the VCs talked about men and women, and I'm going to, the ones I think are the most interesting, if the men were young, they were young and promising. If the women were young, they were young but inexperienced. And then, of course, the women were called good-looking. And then the one that I think is the most annoying to me is the men were described as sometimes cautious, sensible, and level-headed, while the women were called too cautious and does not dare. And that's actually one of the most annoying criticisms of female founders is that we're risk averse. That's why there aren't any women in startup land, because we're risk averse. We don't take chances. Mm-hmm. Fuck you. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. This makes me so mad. and you see it in black and white. And I mean, and when it is 2.1% of VC funding, there is something seriously wrong going on.
I haven't read the survey, but my assumption would be that the majority of the VCs there were men, right?
That's what the industry is,
So, like, that's, I guess, problem number one, right?
Yes.
Like, so in the area of technology in which I play in, which is mostly consumer tech, but reporting and developers, this is an extremely hot button issue right now for good reason in trying to find ways to bring more women into the industry at large. And this is part of the problem, right? Like in that you're trying, people are maybe at like a maybe a middle ground level, people are trying to find more women, foster more women, female talent into development, into software development, to bring them into companies. But at the very top, where these startups are getting their money, it's all men, right? And that and this, like, considering where from like a ground level and a mid level, there's this encouragement for change that I see now, it is harrowing to me to see that the statistics are going down from 7%. Was it 7%, 2% of all funding?
Now it's 2.1%.
In what period of time was that?
This is a few years.
Like, I can't believe that. I cannot believe that, because it feels like at a time where there is more focus than ever from a PR perspective on bringing women in, that behind closed doors is getting worse. Like, I just don't understand how a company could think that this looks good for them.
There was another article I read today, and it just popped up in my head. You know, the unconscious bias is something that's talked about a lot in diversity. Someone's come out with a VC bot, robot, like artificial intelligence, that would, so you wouldn't pitch to a human, which I would love to see what the numbers look like when that happens.
Oh, right. So like it's like a machine learning.
Yeah.
Like it is, you're giving it the figures, the answers, and then it makes a kind of a central, like it makes a neutral response to those, right? Interesting.
Yeah, I can imagine a version of, you know, The Voice, where you're kind of, you're in a chair and you're like, I love this idea. Press the button, turn around. It's like, oh, you're a woman. Okay, I'm still in. Yeah.
There, I call it, you know what, and I'm not putting this down because I like all of these things, but there seem to be a holy trifecta of acceptable female-led businesses, and they're either in fashion and beauty, lifestyle, or motherhood. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like all those three things. I take part in all three of those things. But that's the only place you see celebrated female entrepreneurs, because the other public sphere, the other tech stuff and finance stuff, we're not allowed in that world. And so men see that and they're like, sorry, it doesn't quite. We haven't seen any. We haven't seen, you know, women run this type of business before.
So for female entrepreneurs and women who want to be entrepreneurs, where can they go to learn more, to take steps with people who can support them?
Well, I think you're right that this isn't a big issue, and there are a lot of people that are trying to work hard to change things. I do think there is kind of sometimes a very fundamental difference in how men and women start businesses. I think a lot of women start businesses inside other companies, so they don't go down that angel route and then the VC route. But then, of course, with the semantics, they're not called entrepreneurs. They've done something else. You know, I started my own magazine inside a big corporate, but it was all me. It was all by myself. I did the whole thing by myself. You tell this to a classic, you know, tech entrepreneur, no, you're not an entrepreneur, because you never went for angel funding. You never went for this. Mm. And it's kind of like, well, what do you consider a startup then?
Mm. Well, with that, I'd like to thank our guests, Simon, Andra, Liz, Mike. It's been great to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I got to swear, yay. Woohoo, cool.